Let's see here. I just want to make sure you're not too high up on the levels.
How do I sound to you?
Yeah, you're sounding good. You're sounding like I'm listening to Antifada on my podcatcher.
Nice. I had an opportunity to listen to some of This Machine Kills. You know, I went and I checked when Ed had guested on our show, and it was the year 2021, if you could believe that. Ancient history.
That's so long.
So much water under the bridge.
And we started This Machine Kills in like August of 2020. It was a pandemic project, and I can't believe that's been that fucking long now.
Well, it's obviously been a success if you're still keeping up with it.
Almost 400 episodes in.
That's pretty good. This is officially actually episode 2. I think we've started the podcast at this point. I figured since you're a professional podcaster, I'm a professional podcaster. We're both pros here. And you literally wrote the book on capitalism and technology that we could keep things kind of loose and casual and conversational here. You could bring me along into your tech world, as it were. But I was going to say, the whole AI thing, this is AI Carumba number 2, because we're doing a little mini series. My wife, my beautiful wife, had the idea of calling it, well, I should say my wife and our friends Maddie and Jaya and myself had the wonderful idea of calling this unintelligence, fartelligence or something really terrible. And I was like, no, I had to try to think of something like light and airy and fun. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to our first AI Carumba episode. Did you?
Yeah, no, I heard it with Rax and everyone.
You did your research. I love that. Presumably all the listeners out there, too, have done their research and listened to the episode, too. Very light. We kept it very light. In fact, I would appreciate if between the two of us, and let me introduce you, of course, this is Jathan Sadowski, co-host of This Machine Kills, and also the author of a great new book, your second book, The Mechanic and the Luddite, if I can get the subtitle correct, A Ruthless Criticism of Technology and Capitalism, out now, wherever books are sold. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here. As a long time first time, I've been a fan of Antifada before I had my own podcast, now over 4.5 years ago.
That's really nice to hear. That's good stuff. Thanks for listening. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is AI Carumba 2. As a counterpoint maybe to the first one, where we really did the fun and smart and easy thing, which is to like slag off the complete culture, the whole world of artificial intelligence, of tech, to, as they might say in Australia, I know they say it in Britain, to take the piss out of the whole Silicon Valley thing. Again, a lot of fun. I thought it was a great episode, and I thought we had some smart critiques in it. But I would like maybe our episode here to be a counterpoint to that, where we kind of look more towards like a deep and critical look at the technology, instead of doing the sneering sort of cynical hipster thing where we're like, it's all hype, it's all fucking whatever. We're going to actually take it seriously, or I would like to anyways, as you take it seriously in your book, because, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, we're talking about capital, we're talking about fictitious capital, we're talking about technology, we're talking about actual material processes that have a real effect on the world. So it's easy and it's fun, as in AI Carumba 1, to just like talk shit on this whole tech world. But with your good graces and with your cooperation, let's hope, I'd like to make this one maybe a little deeper and kind of set up the rest of this AI series. How does that sound to you?
That sounds great. I was a little worried when you were like, let's make this a counterpoint to the first one. I was like, man, I'm not on here to tell you why AI is good. I think we got our wires crossed somewhere.
No, by that I meant let's make this extremely boring. If the other one was fun and light and airy.
That was the other thing. It's like, all right, the first one was really fun. It was a great time. Let's make this a counterpoint. We got Jathan on. Let's eat our vegetables. We got the professor on.
Right. Dessert's been done, man. We had our flan in the first course. You know, in reading this book and preparing for this episode here, I created I realized, and I was saying this with Rax earlier, I realized I created something of a heroic narrative for you. Like, I'm not familiar with your whole narrative arc. You know mine enough to know that I've had brain damage, right? But I don't know your arc enough to, like, keep myself from making a heroic narrative for you. So, like, when I picked up your book, which is to say opened PDF, which is about all I'm capable of these days as an elder millennial or younger Gen X, you know, I was like, you know, what's the deal with this? I feel like I'm entering into jumping into a conversation in the middle. Like, you're out of your depth, Donnie, you know, like you're like a child that walks into the room in the middle of a conversation. That's how I felt, because I feel like the work that you do as a professional, as an academic, as a writer, as a podcaster, is up at this very high level where you're immediately situating in the mechanic and the Luddite your critique necessarily sort of above critical, like, gadget review type literature on AI and on technology that you want to try to kind of do a meta critique of, and you use historical materialism to do that. Because you're so serious about the critique, and because your critique is so serious, in my heroic narrative, they like you were Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein, or no, like Frankenstein's monster. You were like this powerful, like aberrant, monstrous force that needed to be pushed from the shores of America deep into the depths of darkest Australia, that your power as a critic, you know, had to be exiled to like the Gold Coast, to Brisbane, or wherever it is that you live in Australia. In my heroic narrative, your thought was too powerful. You're like, no, they'll kill you, Jathan. Like, you're smoked too strong. You know, they pushed you to Australia. Is that true? Do I have your heroic narrative correct, or is it more heroic than that? Have you actually, like, are you on the run for having slain multiple tech oligarchs? Are you responsible for Andreessen's right turn towards Meg? Tell me, I mean, what are you doing in Australia, man? Not to take the piss out of you or nothing, but what's
this
going
is great. I love that I'm adopting this narrative for myself. Look, it's not right, but it's not wrong either. In some ways,
this is how a legend, right, so. Begins. The legend,
yeah, because I do live in Australia. I've been here for almost 8 years. And yeah, you know, I'm from the U.S. and I did all of my, you know, I grew up, I was born in Mississippi, and I kind of threw some of this in the book, actually, where I talk about some of my background and the idea of the mechanic as this kind of role model for a materialist analysis of technological capitalism. But, you know, I was like born in Mississippi and then lived all over the place, ended up, you know, finishing high school in South Dakota and you know, did college in upstate New York and went to grad school at Arizona State University. And then I left, like I finished my PhD and I've never had a job in the US since my PhD. And I did that in 2016. So I left in like July of 2016, right before Trump number one was elected. And I've been back to the US to visit, but I've never lived in the US since then. And part of that was not because I was like, I need to get out of here, but it was because I never got a job offer anywhere in the U.S. at any university in the U.S. Only I moved to the Netherlands for a year. That was my first job. And then after that, I moved down to Australia and been here for almost 8 years. And it is true that, like, the kind of when I started doing critical analysis of technology and getting a PhD somewhere between social sciences and information technology, kind of merging those two with a Marxist political economy lens, it wasn't a very popular way of talking about technology. This is like pre-tech lash. So Silicon Valley still had the benefit of the doubt. This was when everyone's favorite genius was Elon Musk. You know, I saw through all of that shit like very early. I mean, a badge of honor I have is that Elon Musk blocked me on Twitter in like 2015.
Nice.
Because I was harassing him so much, and no one else was. So he wasn't used to it yet. He he was still very thin skinned. I mean, he still is, but at least he is now used to being like, he draws power from being the most hated man in the world.
Right.
Back then he felt he was the most loved man in the world. And he blocked me for a very long time on Twitter. And I hold that as a badge of honor, 'cause I'm like, I was here first.
Well played. He drove you from America to Australia.
Part of your legend. One in, one out policy. So, you know, you take one South African.
He lives in your childhood home now. He gets to live in your childhood home, and he's like a son to your parents. That's a sick, dark fantasy. That's real fucked up. Sorry, I spoke that hopefully not into existence. This leads me to, because Rax isn't on this episode, but she did have one question for you, which is, why are these people so fucking needy? And I couldn't help but think of this question when Elon Musk came up, because, I mean, this guy wears his emotions, he wears his ego on his sleeve, you know, and as he's a very polarizing figure. Very much representing, I think, one psychosocial feature of Silicon Valley, and something that you touch on in your book, which is like the necessity for this tech, whether it's artificial intelligence, as we're talking about specifically, or more broadly, this sort of information technology. It's not enough that it, I don't know, that it makes things more efficient. It's not enough that it makes profits. It's not enough that it employs people. It has to be some sort of world-changing, world-spanning event. It has to be the kind of like realization of some human freedom and some human positive human future that's going to make better humanity for all. Why is this the case? Why are these people at the heart of this enterprise so needy? Why is it gone from something like IBM, maybe there were people at IBM who had these delusions of grandeur about what it was that they were doing, but we didn't hear about it. We got to hear from these fucks all the time. In fact, Elon Musk bought Twitter.com, so we had to hear from him all the time. Why are these people so needy? How do you explain this?
Yeah, I mean, I think a real simple part of this is just a real kind of psychopathology that they have, which is that they are all they are all you know, sociopaths who want to remake the world in their image and demand to be applauded for their ambition, right, for their vision. There is a huge part of that, but that doesn't come out of nowhere, nor is it that like those people rise to the top for no reason. It's like, on one hand, you know, you talk about this heroic narrative you created for me in your mind. Well, we have been doing that in the US for centuries around creating this heroic narrative of the entrepreneur,
right?
And the entrepreneur has taken different roles depending on what was the dominant mode of capital at the time, right? And that kind of defines capitalism. It defines the rules of the game. It defines the kind of cultures around capital. And so you think about, like, you know, in the previous era of like the, you know, robber barons and the Gilded Age and stuff, right? This kind of heroic idea of the entrepreneur was someone that, like, the Great Gatsby, right? Was this kind of like, you know, someone that Fitzgerald would be writing about, or a Rockefeller, right? Someone who, like, it, you know, bestrides the world by the might of his industrial power. And then, you know, at the peak of his life, becomes a philanthropist, right?
Right.
And, you know, funds a bunch of libraries and public service. And so it's this kind of like Citizen Kane model of like the heroic American entrepreneur of capital. And
we think of Carnegie, right? Of course, in this concept of the social gospel, right? Which obviously, as you pointed out, the point of accumulating all this wealth is so that eventually you can do something good with it for society, build, as he did in New York City, libraries, or in Pittsburgh, built universities, you know, Vanderbilt also, of course, built universities. now, but that was like separate from the production process itself. Like the production process and the accumulation of that wealth, we were supposed to applaud him on the entrepreneurialism, rising in Carnegie's case from being like a telegraph operator all the way to being in charge of like a giant trust, you know, and being like an extremely wealthy man. Now it seems like they want to be celebrated before the effects of their technology have even been realized. So what explains that?
Yeah. And so I think the analogy here in that time period is actually more like Henry Ford, right? Who did actually want to be applauded for his industrial capacity. He made it such that the normal everyday person could buy a vehicle, you know? So it's like, I'm bringing this innovation to the masses. And that's the analogy here. You know, we have this heroic cultural narrative of the entrepreneur. And this is, if we go up to today, right, and you see this as well with like finance capital kind of coming up in the 70s and stuff, right? Like you have this idea that like these people are the backbone of society. They are, you know, they are providing capital. They're, you know, they are making things run and they should be applauded for it, but they should also have the ability to access unlimited wealth because they deserve it.
Gordon Gekko. Greed is good.
Exactly. Yeah, and they deserve it. And it is that greed is good, Milton Friedman kind of turning avarice into a virtue. This narrative exists. Now it takes on different forms according to what the dominant mode of capital is at the time. And so if we think about tech capital, you know, it has inflected in that, you know, these ideas of technological progress and vision, you know, the idea that you should be able to drop out of college and have a great idea and by the merits of your own capacity, turn that into a $1 billion startup and not only make a bunch of money, but that's not what you're really in it for. Right. What you're in it for is to, advance civilization to the next step and be applauded for it. And this is what Mark Andreessen is complaining about with Barry Weiss, right, is that the social contract here between Silicon Valley and the rest of the society is that we will provide you with all of the things that you need to make your life better, to advance human civilization, to push progress forward. And in return, we get not only access to lots of money, but adulation and applause for doing it. And Mark Andreessen blames the techlash, the fact that we broke the social contract here. We stopped applauding them, and that is why they all became fascist.
All right, good stuff. Now we're into the politics, right? Because it's one thing to try to psychoanalyze these people, and it's a lot of fun, right? Like, how is a capitalist self-conception, the self-conception of a capitalist changed, you know, over the last 150 years or so? Is a very, very interesting question. But with the tech lash, and now this is the second time you've mentioned that, and this is the in your book was the first time I actually encountered it. It's 2018. This is in reference to when internally, right, Google workers were protesting against Google's implication, Google's various contracts with military contractors. What's the broader context of this tech lash, and what does it end up doing in Silicon Valley in the year 2018?
Yeah. And so 2018 is these Google walkouts around Google's contracts with the Pentagon on Project Maven, right? So, and it's an early AI system designed for target identification, right? It's designed to for an AI to do computer vision, pattern recognition of images, of buildings, of vehicles, of people, and so on, and use that as a way to automatically generate targets, identify targets for drones or missiles or other forms of kinetic warfare, right? And so this is a huge contract that Google had secured with the Pentagon to build these technologies, and it caused this real uproar internally at Google, where you have a bunch of, you know, and this is again, and this is also peak 2018, peak Trump, right? Peak resistance to Trump,
right.
Peak, you know, organizing against, like, you know, the ICE raids and things like that. And, you know, there is a bastion of liberalism in Silicon Valley, especially among the workers there, the coders, the software engineers, and so on. You know, bubbled over into a protest, into walkouts. You know, one of the slogans was "Tech won't build that," right? Mm. And it was this idea that these Google software engineers, programmers, but it also included other tech workers, like, you know, cafeteria staff and janitors, and, you know, the kind of the blue collar workers at these tech companies that actually make things run in terms of the operations there. But it included this kind of wide, broad base movement, a labor movement, saying this is not why we became engineers or programmers or worked at Google, was to build, you know, AI weapon systems. Before that as well, I believe it was 2016, there was also some Google walkouts earlier that were more around gender inequality, right, at Google. And this was, you know, these were also so this kind of laid the groundwork here for, like, you know, some kind of form of collective action by workers who are not happy with internal policies around, like, sexual harassment. That's a lot of what the original kind of Google walkouts were about, is, like, widespread sexual harassment in Google. And so there was some initial walkouts and collective action around gender equality, and then later around tech and military defense contracts.
And so this really tarnishes the conception of these big tech giants, right? Is that why it's called the tech lash? Because it's bigger than just a labor action, bigger than just, you know, the workers of Google. It actually overflows the bounds of that, right?
That's right. It started to push public opinion towards the other end of, these are not companies that deserve a benefit of the doubt, that deserve kind of unalloyed praise or anything, but rather, hey, maybe they're actually doing bad things. Maybe they don't have our own interest at heart. Maybe they are they pursuing profit over some progress mission? You know, so it was like
a real come to Jesus moment for a lot of young programmers and engineers, it sounds like.
Yeah, and also a lot of what pushed the tech lash was a change in the tone by the media. Mm. The tech media started to ask more critical questions, started to view their role as more than just repeating public, like, PR material or doing gadget reviews, but maybe actually investigate these companies as what they are, some of the largest and most powerful companies to ever exist. And maybe they should have, you know, actual investigation and reporting on their doings. And this is something that, you know, the executives and the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley had never really experienced before. They had decades of, you know, a press that was slavishly praising them at every step. And now slight amounts of critical attention, slight amounts of real investigation into their activities, not even like investigations in the, you know, like the Pentagon Papers or Deep Throat or something, but more investigations around, like, just reporting on what they're actually doing rather than what they say that they're doing.
God forbid.
It was like too much for them to handle.
Yeah, again, a bunch of thin-skinned ghouls, like sociopathic, but also thin-skinned at the same time. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention something else happening in 2016, which is Gamergate, right? Wasn't that the height of Gamergate in 2016? So already now, you know, it's at the time, Gamergate, I was vaguely aware of the tech lash. There was that dude who worked for Google. What was his name? Not Jamie Dimon, but it was something like that.
James Damore.
Yeah, there you go.
Fired for truth.
Fired for truth. Like, didn't he write some, like, sexist screed against, like, women programmers or something like that?
Yeah. He wrote, like, some internal memo that got passed around. It was all, fired. Like, you know, IQ, race, science laced, and talking about, like,
calipers.
You know, women are, like, biologically incompatible with, right, software software engineering.
Femoids are incapable of honesty in gamer journalism or whatever. Yeah, yeah. Like, the reason why this is important in retrospect, I think at the time, maybe, I didn't take any of this shit seriously, politically or economically, because it seems like, you know, this is sort of the tail end, too, of zero interest rate program. Like, this is like... a moment in time, and you can probably situate this in the history of Silicon Valley and its various different ups and downs of investment. But like, we should remind ourselves that Mark Andreessen, who's one of the central figures in your book and a central figure of Silicon Valley venture capitalist profit seeking and like bringing together capital in order to like hype and make companies real. Andreessen had two months ago in January had an interview with Ross Douthat. However the fuck you say that, Douthat, in the New York Times, where he says pretty much that his rightward turn comes from this moment, comes from this techlash. These young engineers they were hiring wanted to change the world, and they were pushing back on our honest profit making. And for this reason, I have to be part of the MAGA revolution. And like, we have to do a reverse great proletarian cultural revolution. We have to, I don't know, I guess, what are they doing now? Doge, Social Security. Because some kids were like mean to me at a meeting back in 2016 or 2017 or whatever. So like, there is a deeper history to this, like the intersection of Silicon Valley and the national politics and national political economy. Because now I think it's fair to say that a segment of Silicon Valley is, if not in the driver's seat, at least, you know, like sitting shotgun with President Trump, dictating what gets funded, what doesn't, who gets, you know, who keeps their job, who ends up getting fired, whether or not my mom, when she has a question about her Social Security, can call up the helpful helpline person who maybe lives in like Peoria or wherever it is they live, or South Dakota, and speak with a human being, or whether that's going to be turned into an AI job and like automated away. So there's like real political questions here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I mean, this is also like, this is what a big part of my book and the framing in the beginning is that, you know, we can no longer pretend that we can go on talking about technology as this thing that exists over here and capitalism as this thing that exists over there. And that's, there was this kind of artificial bifurcation that happened in our analysis in academia, in media, in the public, where like somehow Silicon Valley, yes, we knew that they had these things called venture capitalists, and you know, we knew that they were you know, companies and making a lot of money and stuff, but there was always this kind of idea that like technology just kind of exists as its own thing, right? It's a fetish object. It exists as its own thing, disconnected from all other like history and social relations. And Silicon Valley just happens to be like the conduit and the forge for this thing called technology that comes into our lives and changes it for better and for worse, but we can't really do anything about it, right? And like, that was this kind of narrative for a very long time. And I think that like, that's always been wrong, but I think that facade there is starting to crumble in really obvious ways, where it's like, no, like like you can't disentangle capital from technology, because technology is the thing that gives all of these social, economic, historical, political relations a material form. And it gives it material force in society. And it is also the choice or the outcome of a bunch of choices made by people that have the resources and power to allocate capital towards some things and not other things, to have their own values and interests embedded into these systems and into the material forms that they take, that are governed by some imperatives, right? Like, you know, imperatives of capital accumulation, for example. And like the book is trying to break this down, where it's like, we have to understand that right now in the world we live in, there is no technology that is not somehow part of the dominion of capital and capitalism. Because I don't know about you, but like, I don't wake up in the morning and go to like a council where I make decisions about what kind of technologies are going to be created, how they're going to be designed, what worlds they are meant to bring into being.
That's
and so
if the
on.
German like, Revolution of 1919 had succeeded, we would have that council.
Yeah, exactly.
You would have an Australian Soviet, I'd have a New York Soviet, and like we'd all come to terms eventually together.
100%, right? And this, you know, this is. But like, I don't do that, but there are people who do that. And it's like Mark Andreessen is someone who does actually do that. And he does that through the reins of the venture capital firm that he controls, which allocates billions and billions of dollars, right? He does that through the board seats that he has on both major tech firms like Meta and so on, but also smaller startups. He does that through the political lobbying that he does, right? Like he does, like there are actually people who wake up in the morning and make decisions about where to allocate capital, what technologies to build, and so on.
Absolutely.
And like we can't understand technology without understanding that it is this thing that emerges from and is embedded in capitalism, but nor can we understand capitalism without understanding the character of its material form. And yeah. That's these systems, it's these devices, it's these institutions that we think of as the tech sector, but it's also all these like concepts and ideologies that are wrapped up in technology. And this goes back to what we were talking about around like, you know, things around progress and innovation.
This is why I really like your book. And I will say, like, when I first picked it up and I started reading the first, you know, the introduction, I was like a little dubious about trying to take capital and trying to take technology and make them like two different systems, right? But what I realized in the course of reading, you know, the introduction and the rest of the book too, is that you're making an intervention. This is an intervention, and it's an intervention both to like the general public and to students and to people interested in AI, but also like a real intervention into tech and its understanding, its media, its academic expression, its understanding, because like you're clearing a lot of muck out of the way that people like me, like I don't feel like tech journalism. I don't know that much about tech journalism. I know Wired exists. I know if like you open up Wired, it'll tell you like the latest greatest thing coming out of Silicon Valley. I know that I vaguely knew that there's some sort of relationship between criticism and hype. Crita hype, I think, is what you call it in the book. You know, I'm vaguely aware of these things, but your book, I feel like brought me into a world where all of these moving parts and all of these structures and all these actors, these social actors, are made alive, and questions that felt really, I don't know, big and obscure were made clear. So I want to applaud you for that aspect of the book. And in the best way that I think Marx was able to do, I think there's obviously a reason why Marx has to reach into the misty realms of fetishism, right? Of human anthropology to try to understand what capital does. I feel like you do something similar in this book, and it's really easy, I think, to get caught up in the sort of more mystical, like value form, algorithmic capital sort of stuff. Which is to say, it's very easy to become like a Nick Land, like have your mind blown about tech capital and turn into a fascist and or accelerationist or whatever the fuck he is now, right? Because there is something self like abnegating about this. There's a way that like if we follow this thread, if as Sam Altman said and kind of started a huge debate and debacle, if the social contract needs to be shifted, right? If like the rise of artificial general intelligence, which is a question I have for you after this or in the course of this episode, is whether AGI is actually possible. Like with the rise of AGI, we need to start taking a lot of things we took for granted and we need to throw them out the window. The social contract needs to be reworked. Raises the question, right? Like, if we're going to allow this process of AI to continue unhindered, if it's going to be unhindered even by the safeguards that the industry itself allegedly put in when it had all these like ethics in AI foundations that were putting a check on the worst impulses of these big AI films, like it leads us to crazy questions, like Nick Land type questions, like what is the point of a person? If all of my, and we joked about this in iCarumba 1, like if you're taking away like shopping for avocados from me, if you're taking away like my ability, like my need to read entire books in order to synthesize data, compare things with one another, seek out like news articles about current events, find friends, you know, in meet space, you know, like go to bars or whatever. What is the point of a person? What's the point of a human? If like the algorithm is just telling you all the things that you want to buy anyways, what's the point of a market? And ultimately, what's the point of society? Like AI is raising all these questions. What is the point of a person even if at the end of the day, AI is like automating all these processes? There's a lot to throw in your lap, but this is one half congratulations. And second half, like an acknowledgement that the stakes here, I think, are like, are actually big, are actually huge, and bring up these philosophical questions. I would ask you around this Sam Altman and the social contract, like what's the point of a person? What's the point of a person philosophically, and what's the point of a person for AI? Is a person just an object? Is just a data set? Like what's the point of all of this?
Yeah, no, lots of great questions. And I appreciate your congratulations. I appreciate that as well, that that's what you got out of the book, is this is a clear articulation of complex dynamics. Because, I mean, Marx for me is the model here of like how to do this. And you're right, like the book kind of sets up this dichotomy of these two systems of technology and capitalism. And I expected people like yourself who have knowledge of political economy and think about this to be skeptical. But you're right, like the point of setting that up is to then knock it down and say, we have to set up the mystification so we can then demystify it for ourselves.
And it was successful. It worked. Good job.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And so, you know, I think what is the point of a person is a really good question. And I think it's these kinds of fundamental questions that that start to reveal these real differences between how people think about, you know, fundamental questions of like ontology, like the meaning of life and what existence is, and how this is actually the underlying a lot of the philosophies and ideologies that motivate these technologies. Like AI is, I think, in some ways really uniquely a product of this, because AI, like ideas of AI, have been around for a very long time, and they have been the fodder for a lot of science fiction, a lot of speculation, a lot of like cultural theory. So if we think about Nick Land, right, like but it also reveals this thing of like AI is unlike pretty much any other innovation we can think of, like, you know, blockchain or cryptocurrency or a social media platform, whatever. AI is the one thing that looks like a human in the sense of it feels human. And because it feels human, we can imagine it doing anything a human can do, but maybe even doing it better, doing it differently, replacing us, right? And so then it becomes, what's the point of a human? What's the point of a person if you've got this thing that is like a synthetic artificial person? Then how do I have any special? Why am I special in the world? Why do I even exist? Right? And you know, in some ways, I think like the answer to that goes in the same directions. It just depends on like, what are you saying it with a smile on your face? Or are you saying it with a flashlight under your chin? Because I think like someone like Nick Land would look at like the Matrix and be like, the point of a person is to live in a fully like a pod where you're fully simulated. Your whole world is fully simulated, but all of your desires are met, right? You can do anything that you want. You're not just, you know, you are Neo, but not in the sense of you're trying to break out of the pod, but you are fully actualizing your pod life,
right,
you know?
Sure.
And they would see that as like a good thing, right? Like the point of a person is to be, completely served in every way by these technologies, to no longer have to do anything, to worry about them. And so, you know, I think people like Mark Andreessen, Sam Altman, like, I think that's ultimately, they see that as like, that's a good thing. I think a lot of other people see that as that's actually a really bad thing, because it takes away our freedoms, or it degrades what it is to be human. If you think about, like, you know, there's a short story from, I think, 1923 by E.F. Forster or E.M. Forster, called When the Machine Stops. And I start my first book, actually, Too Smart, that came out in 2020, with a epigraph from there, from that book, or from that short story. But it's a great short story from over 100 years ago, where every people live in these underground rooms, like isolated in these underground rooms, but their every need is met by this grand machine, right? And so you don't have to do anything. You just have to live a life of leisure and convenience, but also a life completely like an individual life, isolated from everybody else. And your every need is met by the machine. And people become, they grow up fed and clothed and cared for by the machine, and they become dependent on the machine, but they also create a kind of like a religious relationship with the machine. The machine is God. God is the thing taking care of you, right? And the point of this short story is talking about how people have stopped becoming people. They have just become these kind of dependent husk of themselves, right? No one actualizes anything. No one develops any skills or capabilities. No one does anything that makes you seem like a person. And so it's this short story that is from over 100 years ago that is meant to be a warning against, don't become overly reliant on these machines to the point that you become religiously devoted to the machine. Fast forward 100 years and you've got people like Sam Altman being like, actually, you should do that. And that's actually a really good thing.
These are very powerful people, and they see the machine, right, as a solution to a problem that they in part created, right? Because the machine, or even what Sam Altman and Andreessen believe, if you want to put the most positive spin on it, is some form of like bourgeois socialism, right? Which is to say, like, everybody's isolated. Nobody has like collective power. There's no like free association of producers, but your every need is not only met, but also anticipated. Like those, the things that the, even like the discernment, you know, that we make at the supermarket, you know, between different types of packaged meat or whatever, would presumably be decided for you as well. So there's a way in which, like, in a very vulgar way, meeting people's needs, right, or people's needs being met, stands in for like a more fundamental freedom that we as socialists, communists might imagine, which is about like social, the ability to be social, like a conception of like homo faber, like the ability to like create and rebuild the world as we see fit, or according to some like conscious plan on the part of humanity. Instead, like, our human powers, in a very sort of, you know, Marx talking about opiate of the masses, or the heart of the heartless world, the machine, you know, AI, artificial general intelligence, becomes like this father figure, this telos that, like, ultimately we can give up our human powers, our creative potentials, our ability to create and recreate society and the world and ourselves. We give that up to the machine willingly, and the machine gives back. So I think that the divine aspects of these things is very much wrapped up in like what it has meant to be human, right? And as we like move on from that into other ways of being human, I suppose, it's not surprising that we retain these sort of spiritual elements to like the meeting of our needs, even if they're happening in very alienated ways. Because guess what? For like a couple hundred years, our ways of meeting our personal needs have been very, very alienated, you know, through wage labor and through markets and whatever. So yeah. I don't know where I want to go with that. Do you have any follow-up to that?
I do. Because I think what a lot of this actually belies here is that, I mean, one, like, these machines, they don't work in anywhere near, like, the act. They don't they're not effective anywhere near the kind of capabilities that people claim that they have. There's a lot of, like, check kiting that happens here, right? Like, cashing a check today on the capabilities of a technology and hoping that the money is in the account later when the bill comes due. And
these are the people saying Social Security is a Ponzi scheme.
No, but that's exactly right. Like, there's a lot of that, like, that fictitious capital. So this kind of, you know, speculation. I talk about that a lot in the book as well, because that is a real foundation, a real core of technological capitalism, of Silicon Valley, of venture capital, is this fictitious capital. So kind of speculation, gambling, convincing people of things that don't yet exist. What Nick Land called hyperstition, but in a positive sense, which is this form of a cultural belief that makes itself real. So kind of cultural self-fulfilling prophecy. And for Nick Land and that crew, this was a good thing. And AI for them and the idea of AGI, artificial general intelligence, is for that kind of Nick Landian Silicon Valley crew. You know, when you point out that they're doing that they are believing in something that doesn't exist as a way to try to make it more material, it's like, yeah, no, and exactly. That's actually a good thing.
Yeah, right? That's good, right? right. So like the hype machine, there's like a theory of the hype machine in a way. There's like a theory of them like wish fulfilling their way into like not just money, but also into creating the world that they want to see.
Yeah, it's like the secret, right? It's that you know, it's manifesting, right? If you put enough like vibes into the world, and I talk about this in the book, is like it is this very, you know, idealist mode of thinking about technology and social change. Idealist in the Marxian and Hegelian sense, right? Of like that the engine of society is just your mind palace. It's the kind of desires and vibes and visions and wishes and wants that you have, and this is what pushes society forward. And that's very much a lot like the philosophy of Silicon Valley is this idealist one, and as opposed to a real materialist analysis that is based on, no, what's the actual like political economy here? What's the historical development here? How does this create different conditions that we then live within and respond to? And this is the real kind of counterposing that in the book is always about, like, our understanding of Silicon Valley and of technology tends to be so idealistic, and not idealist in the sense of like optimistic or whatever, but idealist in the sense of we just think that it's all like visions and vibes and wishes and wants, you know, and it causes us to not understand the underlying political economy, which is actually moving these things forward, which is actually the engine behind the engine of the hype machine. You only get the hype machine because you have a material underlying basis that needs people to rally around things that don't exist yet, right?
And then the hype machine, or the criticism of the hype machine, then becomes hype in and of itself, because you have all these people who take a sort of surface understanding or surface look at say AI or crypto or NFTs, Bored Apes or whatever it is, and they're like, oh, we have to be careful, these things are too powerful. You know, like we have to control these things, there's too much money and power in them, simply we have to, like, as a society, come together and do something about it, which serves the people who are in control of these resources, serves them very well, because they're like, yeah, you're right, they are too powerful, but also they're in like good hands, you know, you can trust Sam Altman. OpenAI did start as a nonprofit, right? Now it's a profit, I think. So
no, that's exactly right. Like, these things are the most powerful. You're right. These things are the most powerful, world-destroying things to ever exist. It's a good thing that we are the responsible stewards of them. I have to give a big shout-out to the historian of technology, Lee Vinsel, who coined the term crit-a-hype, and he coined it in the critique of Shoshana Zuboff's surveillance capitalism, which he saw as doing this kind of crit-a-hype where your critiques of the thing make the thing more real, because, you know, if you critique the thing based on the marketing copy and the baseless claims and the speculation, right, if you take that at face value, and if that's your only understanding of these technologies and systems and sectors, and then by making that the focus of your critique, you end up fetishizing it and you end up contributing to making it more real. Because here's the thing about the hype machine. At the end of the day, it doesn't care if you're cheering or if you're jeering, if you're applauding or if you're booing. At the end of the day, you're still feeding it with your psychic energy,
right,
and you're helping to make it more real. In the book, and I've written a little op-ed about this around, you know, in support of the book, I call this the Tinkerbell effect, where, you know, in the story of Peter Pan, Tinkerbell only exists if you believe in her. And if you stop believing in her, as happens in Peter Pan, she starts fading away. And then she implores the audience, clap, clap, clap louder. And it's this way to get the audience participation into the story, get the audience clapping and cheering for Tinkerbell, and she becomes more material again. And that's exactly what Silicon Valley does, is they say, I don't care if you're clapping or if you're booing, but give us your psychic energy, please, please, please. And it's this way of getting audience participation into making this thing real.
And yet, my technique, which I've honed over the last 10 years or so, which is to disregard all this stuff as like ephemeral, isn't a good technique either. Turns out that you can ignore this stuff until it blows up in your face. We're going to transition to a bonus pretty soon, but I want to leave you with like a reflection I had, because I had some time the other night and I sat down and I rewatched Oppenheimer. Right. Oppenheimer is about technology. It's about a different type of technology. It's about a very visceral technology, splitting the atom. Right. Splitting the atom, of course, as we know from the film, great film. I very much enjoyed it. It had its problems when, you know, the property is theft thing. I was talking to a friend, Ian, and he's like, yeah, when they attributed property is theft to Marx, that was such a boneheaded move. And I said, I almost turned the movie off. But then I said to myself, no. All right, we have to allow people.
You
have
people like us being like, "That's Proudhon, that's Proudhon."
But no, my pet theory is that that's meant to show that Oppenheimer and all these commies are fucking blowhards and don't know the difference between Proudhon and fucking Marx. But anyways, moving on. The point of it is that, and you mentioned this early on in your book, like the moonshot. Okay. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, in the early 1960s, makes a speech. He says, choose to go to the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard, you know? And he gets all of, like, not all of, but, like, the forward-thinking, the vanguard of American society and media and academia and in the workplace and everywhere to, like, get on board with the idea of a moonshot, you know? So this great, you know, similar to what Oppenheimer does with the with the Manhattan Project and then civilian nuclear power after that and whatever, these things really grab people, you know, this conception of changing the world in this way. It seems like with AI now, we've reached a moment, you talk about subsumption in the book, where like a lot of the things like indoor plumbing and transportation have really been solved. And so we're getting into more and more abstract ways of like, not applying technology to human life per se, but finding profitable ways to intervene in social life, in consumer life, in ways that will like make people in Silicon Valley and Wall Street a lot of money, right? So like the low-hanging fruit is gone. Instead of Oppenheimer, you know, with the cool glasses on in a bunker watching the Trinity explosion, like this massive destructive potential of the atom unleashing the forces of the universe. Instead, you've got like Sam Altman, this fucking nerdy guy standing up there and being like, we got to change the social contract. And everybody, instead of like the moonshot, everyone would be like, yeah, we're going to, everyone's like, no, as bad as our social contract might be now, it sounds like what you're providing us is way, 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 way worse. So to get us out of the main episode and towards the bonus episode, like, why does it feel like, I don't know, these people aren't convincing us, that they're convincing themselves, but they're not convincing us. I don't know. And is AGI possible? Like, is it just high? I don't know. Take us out, Jathan. You're a professional.
No, I think I think this is a great question because it also really gets at the at another core difference of like what's different about now than like previous modes of American empire or capital. You know, if we think about, and you know, you have people like Alex Karp, right, the CEO of Palantir.
I fucking hate that guy. Someone should, oh god, redact him. Alex, sorry, go on.
I feel like another person I've been really early on since. Alex Karp has been at the very top, at least in the top three of my own personal hit list, since at least 2015.
Personal hit list. He's like a personal Hitler, man. Like this dude, like talking about how his AI has been used in like Israel to like, oh my god, dude. Ah, sorry, go on. And Alex Karp.
I live in Melbourne, Australia now, and I was walking. I was walking through Melbourne one day, and going on the opposite side of the side, like walking on the opposite way on the sidewalk from me, was a guy who I was like 90% sure was Alex Karp.
Oh no!
Like he looks very, you know, he looks very unique, and I know, and yes. I know, I have like Terminator vision. Like I will always identify his face, and I was almost sure it was him, but. Part of me was like, I need to turn around. I need to like yell Alex, or like, I need to verify, is this him? But then the other part of me was like, no, don't do that, because you've promised yourself if you ever see him in public, you will do something about it. You will Luigi him. and so I was like, I have to keep walking the other way. I cannot verify his identity because I will then have to do something about
it. This brings another the dark legend. Legend of Jathan. It's that like you were pushed from the shores of America and freedom because you were like a little Luigi prototype, just like you wanted to go to Silicon Valley and take care of all the Alex Karps of the world. Instead they're like, why don't you go take a job in Australia where there's no Silicon Valley? There's like a Gold Coast or whatever. There's like surfing or scorpions, koalas, whatever they have down there. You don't have to like assassinate any CEOs down there. But anyway, so Alex Karp, yeah, we were saying. Yeah,
all right, I'll move on. I'll get on to the... So the point of that was as well that Alex Karp, Palantir took over Project Maven from Google, which was the whole idea that sparked the tech lash. So there's also this kind of like, you know, there's all these like a few... actors here, but I bring up Karp because, you know, and he wrote a whole, you know, big essay in the New York Times as part of this new book he just had come out called The Technological Republic, where he talks about how they are the modern day Oppenheimers, right? Creating these AI weapons systems. They are the modern day Oppenheimers. They explicitly say, you know, AI should be the new Manhattan Project and all of that, right? And they say this with you know, all of the fury of, like, you know, American jingoistic, fascistic pride.
Yo, I'm sorry to stop you, but not for nothing. But, like, part of the whole, like, subplot or main plot of the Oppenheimer movie was that maybe it was sufficient to bring these resources and these powerful weapons of mass destruction to bear when there's Nazis. But, like, once the Nazis are taken care of, maybe these things are better left under like international hands. Like we should. And this guy is just like Oppenheimer, we're going to create the killing perfect weapon without any thought about what happens with it after, you know, like AI murder drones. Let's go. Sorry, go on.
The Nazis are an important aspect of this.
Yeah.
It makes it what's different about Manhattan Projects, the Sputnik moment, and today is that, you know, the thing that rallied people around the, you know, nuclear, the atomic bomb and nuclear energy, the thing that rallied people around, you know, landing a man on moon and space flight and all that, these were products of geopolitical competition and a real sense of geopolitical existential threat, right? On one hand, it's the Nazis and the axis of evil, right? And you've got like, okay, there's a real existential geopolitical threat happening now, and we have to, you know, get the greatest minds of American science and innovation together to figure out a way to deal with this once and for all, right? And so that gets people rallied around it. It's something outside of the technology that then gets people rallied around the technology. Same with Sputnik. this is about the Cold War. This is an existential competition between America and the Soviet Union. And so it's something outside the technology, something geopolitical in nature, something geoeconomic in nature, something that has this like existential threat. But again, it's outside of the technology that can then gets people rallied around the technology as the symbol, the solution, whatever it might be. AI doesn't have that. It's all internal to the technology and to the desires of capital, right? There is, you know, they're trying to get that going with this, like, China, right? Like, we need to do this now. Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, who's, you know, also a huge lobbying and really deeply embedded in the Pentagon, kind of bringing Silicon Valley culture and capital into the Pentagon. He's been one at the forefront of this, like, banging the drum that AI is actually the front line of the war against China. And you see Sam Altman, you see people do it, but you can also tell that they're doing it in a really cynical, ad hoc way. Their heart isn't in it, because at the end of the day, AI, like getting people rallied around, coordinated around this, there's nothing outside the technology. It's all internal to the technology. And so there's nothing there that most people really feel any excitement or allegiance to. And so you have this astroturfing by capital to get people, it's a supply side driven boom to try to then force consumer demand, right? And so, but there's nothing outside of that economic relationship, nothing geopolitical, nothing existential besides the technology. They're even trying to do that. The technology itself is the existential threat, right?
Right.
And so the reason why this is failing is because it is so self-contained within this relationship between AI and capital that nobody's convinced by it. There's nothing there to force you, nothing political, to make you care about this economic relationship.
And I'll leave you with the last word in this episode. Where would you like people to buy your book from? Because they're obviously going to buy it after this. So where would you like them to buy it from?
Please. But I recommend like bookshop.org, right? So that you can buy it from a small local bookseller. But hey, you know, if that's not available to you, I won't condemn you for wherever you have to get the book.
Just plug the name of the book into Grok and just let the computer do the work.
That's right. Just ask Grok to write the book for you and then just read it based off of what Grok says.
There you go. That's the future of all of us. Let's go to a bonus episode. Thank you so much for being on, Jathan. Everyone listen to This Machine Kills. Great episodes, great podcasts, good stuff. And we'll see you on the, I almost said on the fun half. I think that's Majority Report. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. We'll see you guys on the other side. Thanks again, man. Okay. All right. Welcome back, everybody. You're in bonus territory here.